You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, February 20th, 2026. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. Since 2017, Rabble.ca and the Institute for Change Leaders have presented the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship, a fellowship with the objective of supporting emerging writers and journalists who are passionate and engaged in developing unique voices in social change reporting. Our current fellow is Bridget Pataski. This week on Rabble Radio, Bridget sits down with Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to talk about her series on Canada's recent frequent use of the notwithstanding clause and what her plans are after the fellowship wraps. Here is Nick Seabrook with Bridget Pataski in conversation. Take a listen.
I'm here with our Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow for 2025-2026, Bridget Pataski. Bridget, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Good, good. I think this is the first time where we've featured one of our fellows on the podcast. It's something that I think we've wanted to do for a while because the Jack Layton Fellowship Program is something that's near and dear to my heart. And I think one of the most important things that Rabble does. So just to introduce our readers a little bit to that concept, the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship started quite a number of years ago. Every year, Rabble picks one, sometimes two, but usually just one young and up-and-coming journalist to be our fellow for a few months here at Rabble. This year's fellowship is presented in partnership with our friends over at the Institute for Change Leaders. We really appreciate their support for the past several years in making sure that this fellowship can happen. And basically, the goal of this fellowship is to give young journalists a chance to learn a few things about the trade of journalism, give them opportunities to cover breaking news stories, and to do a long-form feature project. Each fellow is asked to pitch to Rabble what their long-form project will be. It's supposed to be aimed at an important social or political issue. It can come in the form of a few different ways, usually in the form of a long-form feature story of about 5,000 words. Bridget is doing their feature pitch on the notwithstanding clause, and it has been a series that we've been publishing on Rabble. We're getting ready to publish our next edition of that series, so please keep your eye out on rabble.ca for that. But before we go a little bit more into that subject, Bridget, would you like to talk a little bit about what made you want to apply for the fellowship?
So I had taken politics at Toronto Metropolitan University, and it was a degree that it's hard to know what to do with it once you're done. And then I had done work for lawyers practicing international humanitarian law, where I would do research for them in their efforts to prosecute war crimes, the crimes against humanity, combat transnational repression, and more. And I actually realized through that work how similar that is to journalism. There is obviously an investigative aspect to it. It's about the pursuit of justice for the people, regardless of, you know, which side of the aisle people fall on politically or where they may come from in the world. It's just about doing what's right and following what's objectively true. And so that kind of opened my eyes up more to journalism, and also hearing the personal testimonies of people who have been subject to the worst imaginable circumstances opened my eyes up to the power of storytelling and how impactful that could be in mobilizing change. And so that's something that I also see journalism as a useful vehicle for, in changing public opinion or at least sparking a larger debate in political discourse around policy and if it's being used in a just way or not.
All right, well said. And, you know, just as you explained your experience, obviously, you know, this fellowship isn't always aimed at people who have a strong previous work experience in journalism. We want to give opportunities to people who maybe want to start their way in the field and give them a leg up and give them some experience that they can use to further advance their career or their interest in journalism, if that's the direction they want to go. We've had people who've come to us with a lot of experience in journalism and who've gone on to work at places like the Hill Times. We've had others who have had very little experience and have gone on to do their master's at Columbia in journalism and you know, things of that nature and gone on to other careers. And in terms of writing bridges, has that been something that you always enjoyed?
Yeah, it definitely is. And one thing that appealed to me specifically about Rabble is that it's an outlet that covers activism specifically, and that's something I had been involved in. So it was kind of a way for me to combine two things I care very deeply about, which is writing and social justice and advocacy movements. And so that is something that I've really been enjoying exploring with Rabble.
Absolutely. And before we get into your feature pitch and talking a little bit about that, I wanted to first talk about some of the other work that you've done here at Rabble, because we do like to give our journalists a wide breadth of experience. And Rabble is unique for an outlet of our size in that we work in multiple mediums. We work in video, we work in audio, we work through newsletters, we work through print. And how has your experience been so far in the fellowship?
It's been good. I mean, what the best part of it, as I keep saying to everybody else who's been asking me about it is an excuse to talk to people who are so much smarter than me, who have so much more lived experience than I am, and getting to hear their insight and their direct experience being involved in these issues that I'm exploring has been very insightful and illuminating. And so I've loved being able to do that. And through this work, I've also really enjoyed covering foreign affairs. My first story was about budget cuts to foreign aid that had been proposed in the, well, it's now passed, but the federal budget. And so that's something that I've really enjoyed focusing more on. And it's something that I think is really important because it can often just be overlooked because people don't think it's relevant or applies to them or affects them in any way. And so I've really enjoyed writing about that in particular and hearing from experts in those fields.
Now, one skill that, you know, we try to help our journalists with here at Rabble is pitching. You know, obviously, the very process of applying for the fellowship involves a pitch. But I will say, you know, I've always been very impressed that you always come to our weekly story meetings with a pitch ready. And I just wanted to ask, you know, how do you decide, you know, what stories you want to pitch? You always seem to have a very good sense of what I'd be looking for as an editor for coverage here at Rabble. What stories do you find tend to really pique your interest?
Well, the ideas come to me kind of easily because I'm just an avid news watcher and reader. So there's always so much going on that sometimes it's not hard coming up with an idea. It's hard picking a specific one to focus on. But I definitely also care to write about topics that I know will resonate with Rabble's audience, which I think are things that challenge the status quo more and prompt people to critically think about certain policies that have always been in place that we've just accepted as normal, or certain orthodoxies that no one has really questioned. And so I try to write in a way that is not with an agenda specifically to change someone's mind on a specific subject, but just to show a perspective to get people to think deeper or just think differently about certain issues. And as long as that perspective is considered, then I feel like I've done my job effectively, as long as people are thinking about it, debating it. And so, yeah, I always try to do something that will just try prompt a larger conversation. And yeah, that's how I choose topics.
Now, you mentioned your first story, and I really enjoyed reading it. Really great to have that coverage of the budget on Rabble. What are some of the other stories that you've done that kind of stick out in your mind? And are there any interviews that you've done that you found really impactful for you?
Yes, the story I did about Sudan was something that was really impactful for me to do. It was in regards to Canada deepening its partnership with the United Arab Emirates, which has been credibly accused of supplying the rapid support forces in Sudan with weapons to carry out what many human rights groups consider a genocide, or at the very least, mass atrocities against innocent civilians. And so that's something that I just think is morally urgent. And human rights standards are something I think that the government should always be applying in how it conducts its foreign policy. And I think that's something we're seeing fade slowly out of perspective when it comes to forging partnerships with the countries that we are. And so that was something that was particularly impactful for me to write about. And I interviewed someone from the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab at Yale University, and he had a lot of very interesting insight to offer that he was geolocating kind of arms being smuggled between the two entities, and he was looking at gold being smuggled between the two countries, and all of that was just from satellite imagery. And so that was super interesting to learn about. And then I also got to interview someone from Doctors Without Borders, which was maybe more emotionally compelling rather than understanding the technical stuff as to how all of this information is gathered, and to hear those experiences of how, she's witnessed starvation and massacres and entire communities that have been decimated, and hospitals that have been bombed. And hearing that perspective was something that felt really impactful to not only listen to, but to write about and to share with a larger audience.
All right, and let's also move on and talk a little bit about your feature series. You pitched to us to do a series of stories on Canada's notwithstanding clause in the Constitution. Could you tell us a little bit about the notwithstanding clause and why you wanted to cover this as your feature story?
Yeah, so the notwithstanding clause is section 33 of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which in layman's terms basically says that the government can disregard all of the previous stated rights, or the majority of the previous stated rights, and pass legislation notwithstanding them, that violates equality rights, violates people's rights to be free from arbitrary search and seizure. It could, in theory, violate their due process rights, their religious freedom, and so on. And there's no recourse really outside of the electoral process, which is only when those elections come up, like every few years. Other than that, the courts can intervene and strike that legislation down on the grounds that it's unconstitutional, because the notwithstanding clause protects those laws from judicial scrutiny, basically. And why I decided to write about it was because it's something that has grown quite rapidly in its use. It's been used by the government in Alberta against LGBTQ communities, as well as in Saskatchewan. It's also been used against labor rights in Ontario and Alberta. One that I'm very eager to cover is how it's been used in Quebec in particular, because I think that fits into a broader framework of discussions of regional tensions in Canada and separatist movements. But it has been used against religious freedom rights, predominantly against Muslims in Quebec. And so that's something I'm really looking forward to covering. And I think that the growing use of it represents kind of a crisis in liberal democracy, because there are very real and legitimate fears that it is deeply undermining our individual liberties, and it's eroding minority rights. It's being used to go after vulnerable communities. And I think people in Canada can be so focused sometimes on what's happening to the south of us, and the backsliding of democracy there, that we forget we face, maybe not to the same extent, but we face similar threats here, and we have the tools that could make it much easier, actually, but that's a different discussion. But yeah, we have the tools available to us that could make the backsliding of democracy here very rapid and destructive. And so I just think it's something that people should be informed about and involved in discussions about. And we should have an informed electorate so that if there are decisions being made using the notwithstanding clause, elected officials can be held accountable the next time in election comes around, because then that's the only form of recourse we have. But I've always felt like not enough people pay attention to it or care enough about it, especially my age. So I really wanted to put my sole focus there for the series.
Yeah, well, I think that was a really interesting point that you just made, that we look to the south, we look what's happening in the US, and we thought, oh, there are so many guardrails in this constitutional democracy. Yeah. Protecting individual rights. And now we're seeing those rights violated. And we think it can't happen here. But a lot of people aren't aware that it's kind of built into the Constitution that it can happen very easily here, that rights can be violated. So just, you know, your first part of the feature series talked about the sort of laid the groundwork for the rest of the series and talked about the history of the notwithstanding clause. Could you quickly just let us know from what you explained in that story, why it was included in the Constitution at all?
Well, at the time it was viewed by Pierre Trudeau as a necessary evil to include it in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I believe he basically said that it's better to have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms with a notwithstanding clause than to not have one at all. And it was a part of an overall effort to patriate the Constitution, because before that, if we wanted to amend the Constitution, we still had to go to the United Kingdom to do it, despite being technically an independent country. And it was felt by many that we couldn't truly have independence if we still had to ask another country for permission to amend one of our most fundamental texts. And so it was something he had to engage the provinces on and the premiers on. It was something the court said. I believe the court said he needed the majority of the premier's support to be able to patriate the Constitution and add our own amending formula. And then with that, he wanted to add the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is akin to the Bill of Rights in the United States. Not many countries have a Charter of Rights or a Bill of Rights. Like, not many countries have full constitutional judicial review the way we do and the way the United States has. And that was viewed as something integral to the strength of a liberal democracy. But there was lots of pushback from the premiers, specifically when it came to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, because they felt like that limited provincial autonomy and that Ottawa was frequently out of touch with what the needs of the provinces were. And so that was basically the best, or what they felt was the best kind of middle ground between preserving their province's sovereignty and their provincial kind of culture, those cultural differences, and having an overall Charter of Rights and Freedoms that can, at least in theory, guarantee everybody their individual rights on a national level. And then obviously there is Quebec too, which has their own culture and separatist movement, and Quebec had invoked the notwithstanding clause, I think, on every piece of legislation following the enactment of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms as a form of protest, because they were against it. And the Premier of Alberta was somebody who was very instrumental in the inclusion of the notwithstanding clause, though how they originally envisioned its use has really differed from how it is being put into practice today.
All right. And, you know, for your next installment in the series, I believe you're touching on labor rights. Is that correct? And
yes. Yes.
Can you give us a quick overview about some of the cases of the notwithstanding clause being used at labor rights?
Yeah, so it's been used in Alberta and Ontario against workers who are on strike. And the right to strike, I believe, is something the Supreme Court said is a charter right in Canada. And so it's been used particularly against teachers and QP workers in Ontario. And so I'm really eager to interview representatives from those organizations who can give me more insight on why the right to strike is so important for workers, for our democracy, what the right to strike too has won all of us in the past and why it's so important to preserve that. And still, I just want to always emphasize the use that even if you don't agree maybe with the merits of what certain advocacy groups are in the pursuit of, it's still worthy to be critical of the use of the notwithstanding clause to fight against them because of how it can affect our democracy more broadly. And so that's a point I always want to drive home by also talking to law professors and constitutional scholars and anyone who could give me more of a legal perspective, not just an advocacy one.
All right, excellent. And, you know, before I let you go, just talking about the fellowship again, obviously, you know, the fellowship will be, your term as our fellow will be coming up, sadly, to an end soon. We'll be sorry to see you go. But for you, what do you hope to do next after you've done your fellowship?
Oh my gosh, that's such a big question. I think about that all the time. Like I said previously, I really love writing about foreign affairs. And so that's something I would really love to focus on more, especially advocacy groups in other countries and social justice movements in other countries. And, you know, as I kind of stated earlier, we're seeing a backsliding of democracy in the United States. We're seeing growing anti-immigration sentiment around the world, and an increase of just populist demagogues popping up all over. And so that's something that I would love to focus on through my writing in the future, for sure.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Bridget, for joining me today for this conversation about your feature series and for the Jack Layton Fellowship as a whole. I'll say to anyone listening, if you are interested in learning more about the Jack Layton Fellowship, please visit rabble.ca. If you want to follow Bridget's feature series, again, see us on rabble.ca and keep an eye on Rabble and our social media feeds this coming fall as we open up applications for our 2026-2027 Jack Layton Fellowship Program. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.
That was Rabble editor Nick Seabrook and our Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow Bridget Pataski. Thanks so much for that, Nick and Bridget. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on rabble.ca. Here again is Nick Seabrook. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with labor news. Amazon has been found to have illegally been freezing the wages of workers at their warehouse in Delta, BC. The company did not provide workers at the warehouse with their contractually scheduled wage increase in 2025. Unifor, which represents the workers at the warehouse, filed a complaint with the BC Labor Relations Board, which found that the company was illegally withholding the wage increase. For its part, Amazon claims that the wage increase was being withheld because their workers were newly unionized, a claim that the Labor Relations Board dismissed. Amazon has a history of anti-union behavior. 1 year ago, Amazon closed all of its warehouses in Quebec after workers there attempted to unionize. Nearly 2,000 workers lost their jobs because of this union-busting action. The Amazon warehouse in Delta, BC is the only unionized Amazon warehouse in Canada. Staying with labor news, workers represented by the Union of Canadian Transportation Employees are concerned that cuts to the federal public service will impact their ability to do their jobs, which includes enforcing airplane safety. In Mark Carney's 2025 federal budget, the Prime Minister promised to eliminate 40,000 federal public sector jobs and make deep cuts to federal spending. Transport Canada is one of the federal agencies being hit by cuts this year, and is the agency responsible for air traffic safety, among other things. Over 1,500 workers at Transport Canada have been notified so far this year that their positions may be affected by restructuring. Teresa S. Chuck, president of the Union of Canadian Transportation Employees, said that Transport Canada was not being open with their members about the future of the agency and what it will look like after the cuts, saying, quote, "Employees are being asked to make life-altering decisions about their employment future while key information about future organization structures, regional footprints, reporting, relationships, and operational models is incomplete," end quote. In national news, writer Linda McQuigg argues that while Mark Carney keeps national attention on Donald Trump, tariffs, and U.S. threats to Canadian sovereignty, he's quietly giving gifts to corporations in the form of deregulation. Currently before Parliament is Bill C-15, which is an omnibus piece of legislation aimed at enacting part of Mark Carney's 2025 federal budget. Included in the act is a provision allowing cabinet ministers to exempt corporations from any law or regulation as long as the cabinet member believes it will help the company advance economic growth or innovation in Canada. McQuigg warns that the legacy of deregulation is one that has often led to lower wages and less safe working environments. One of the most notorious examples of this was the Lac-Mégantic train disaster in 2013. In the lead up to the disaster that killed 47 people, the federal government under Stephen Harper had gradually reduced federal oversight of rail safety in the name of profits. And finally, in environmental news, writer David Suzuki highlights the Butterfly Way project, which is entering its 10th year. Bees and butterflies are key pollinators that help ensure that plants that form the basis of our ecosystem can flourish. However, climate change and overdevelopment has led many of these plants becoming scarce, threatening butterfly and bee populations. The Butterfly Way project was started in 2017 to address this scarcity. Members of the project commit to planting native wildflowers and share seeds with their neighbors to help ensure that these plants remain in our environment and that bee and butterfly populations remain supported. And as always, you can read about the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week.